The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, Jozza. Add my welcome to Jozza's. Great to have you along at the Bible Shots for another week, where we take some time out to look at the Bible and think about what it has to say to us today. Like Craig said, this is the last talk in our Unstuck series, where we've been looking at a part of the Bible called Colossians. For those who are geographically minded, it was the town of Colossae was about there in modern-day Turkey, but this letter was written by Paul in 60 to 70 AD. And we've been seeing that Paul wrote this letter because he wants the Colossian followers of Jesus he's writing to get unstuck and stay unstuck so that they can live the lives they were made for. That's what we've been seeing over the past few weeks. You don't need to be a follower of Jesus to join us. As long as you're happy to consider what the Bible has to say, we are glad that you are here. There are some potentially confronting parts in today's passage. We'll get to them in due course. But the part of the Bible we're looking at today, it builds on what we've been looking at. It builds on the assumption that the claims of Jesus are true. And it gives a little bit more of an understanding of what life following Jesus looks like and what it's shaped by day, hence one day at a time. It could also function as something of a comparison to your own life. If you're considering what the Bible has to say, it could function as a bit of a comparison to think about what shapes and drives you. So today we're particularly considering what characterizes the day-to-day life you were made for. Questions like, what does it look like to live the life you were made for each day? If today is less than successful, what could you do about it? And how could you work out if it has been a good day? They're the sort of questions that hopefully you might be able to answer by the end of today's talk. Because there's plenty of options that are out there that would suggest answers to these questions. You may have come across the 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss. If you haven't, let me read the blurb to you. Forget the old concept of retirement and the rest of the deferred life plan. There is no need to wait and every reason not to, especially in unpredictable economic times. Whether your dream is escaping the rat race, experiencing high-end world travel, earning a monthly 5-figure income with zero management, or just living more and working less, this book is the blueprint. That sounds kind of cheesy, but it is a highly reviewed book. It's a New York Times bestseller. 83% of the 5,361 reviews on Amazon gave it 4 stars or higher. If that's the sort of life you're made for, it could offer the advice you need. It also gives you a fairly easy metric for assessing how successful each day is. So if you've worked more than 48 minutes today, according to this book, you are failing. You're getting less and less successful the further away you get from that goal. But as we look at this section of Colossians today and consider the day-to-day life we were made for, we're going to do it with 3 main points. We're going to see it starts with Jesus, we're going to consider what the heart wants, and we're going to see that it ends with Jesus. There are 3 points for today. It starts with Jesus, it's what the heart wants, it ends with Jesus. So first off, it starts with Jesus. This day-to-day life might have a particular shape, but Paul's clear he's not holding out a moral improvement plan. He's not holding out a moral improvement plan. It's actually about living out the vision of the gospel that he's been unpacking as we've looked at Colossians over these last few weeks. It all starts with Jesus. Have a look there at verse 1 that Craig read out before. Since then, you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. The key thing for followers of Jesus is to be driven by things that are above. It's not saying that you should be detached from earthly things, like some Eastern philosophies might suggest. As we'll see, the instructions Paul gives are very much focused on the nitty-gritty of day-to-day realities. But following Jesus, rather, is no longer about living for self. making my name great, taking what I want as the starting point for what gives my life direction. Instead of what I want, it's actually about Jesus and his rule. And this is not just the right thing, but a good thing because of how Jesus has shaped the past, the present, and the future of his followers. The pattern we've actually been seeing as we've looked at the rest of the letter. Jesus has impacted the past, present, and future of his followers. So he's impacted their past. Verse 1, they have been raised with Christ. It's a change that's happened. Or verse 3, you died. Past tense. Trusting Jesus, in fact, has changed things so radically, Paul calls it a change from death to life. This change that's in the past, though, has resulted in a change of present situation for followers of Jesus. Verse 1, you have been raised with Christ, who is seated at the right hand of God. Or verse 3, your life is now hidden with Christ in God. The claim is that followers of Jesus are already seated at God's right hand, the position of rule and power, united with God because they're united with Jesus. The change in the past has impacted their present, but it also impacts the future. Verse 4, they're looking forward to the day when Jesus returns because that is where their glorious end point is. Jesus has made a change that's impacted their past, which impacts their present and will impact their future. In some ways, it's just like any big change you can experience. You know, if you've moved countries or changed to a different part of the city, maybe even just changed job and office locations, and the plan is to be at this new location for a long time, you'll be starting to make day-to-day decisions that reflect the new reality. You know, not only do you start to find, you know, new places to get chores done, new place for shopping, new place for lunch, new place that serves good coffee near your office, it's going to impact on some of the priorities that you have. You know, you'll start to need to get to know your new neighbours or new colleagues, start to understand what some of the issues of importance in your new location are and what they mean for you. But Paul's point is the message of Jesus changes our situation so radically that it completely reorders the priorities that followers of Jesus have, no longer placing themselves first, but actually placing Jesus first, because followers of Jesus are with Christ in God, and glory is their endpoint. Jesus is the starting point, so set your heart on things above. Living out the vision that Paul holds up means change. There are some things that need to be stopped and some things that will need to be started. But Paul wants us to see, I think, that actually it's all about what the heart wants. Whenever you start a new phase of life, it means leaving old ways behind because they just don't make sense in the new context that you're in. And that's what we're going to start to see in this new section. Now, I'm going to read the section, then I'll address a couple of issues that it might raise, and then we'll think a little bit further about what the text says. So let's have a look there at that second paragraph, starting at verse 5. Paul says, "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways, in the life you once lived. But now you must also rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Don't lie to each other, since you've taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator." From sex to speech, there's no area of our lives that following Jesus does not touch on. But before we get into these verses, particularly in the context of the media frenzy surrounding Israel Folau's Instagram post, Paul does say some things that are potentially confronting. And I want to be absolutely clear. If you're here today and you're considering what the Bible has to say, you are welcome. We are glad that you are here. Whatever your sexual orientation or experiences, you are welcome here as we consider the Bible and what it says. You might not be convinced by what it says. You might even disagree, and that's okay too. We want to help people ask the bigger questions and think carefully about what the Bible says and why. You are welcome here as we do that. Second, I mentioned earlier that the context of the letter is actually this passage is unpacking what following Jesus looks like. If there are things here that actually seem ridiculous, stupid, maybe even harmful, a question to ask would be, well, why is it that so many people have actually been convinced that this is not just the way they should live, but that this is a good and right way to live, that this is a life that's worth living? If you have a friend who's a follower of Jesus who's come along here, you might want to ask them, well, why do they follow Jesus even when it is costly? Or if you'd like to talk further, I or someone else from City Bible Forum would be happy to do that too. You could let us know via the feedback form. Always happy to grab a cup of coffee and ask questions and answer questions and talk. The context in the passage is, if you've decided to follow Jesus, what does it mean your life looks like day to day? We could spend more time than we have available discussing issues currently in the media, and if you have questions in our Q&A time, I'm happy to do my best to answer them. But if we're seriously on about considering what the Bible has to say and what it means for our lives, we actually need to remember that when the Bible says sexual immorality, it isn't talking about one particular issue that happens to be under the microscope in our culture at the moment. Actually, it means any sexual activity outside the Bible's picture for marriage. What's more, when it goes on to talk about impurity and lust, I think it underlines the fact that Paul's not just picking out a few individuals to pick on. Paul is drawing our attention to a problem everyone has. And so as we start looking at the text more closely, it's worth noticing Paul's not creating some sort of alternative to Christianity that Jesus would never have approved of. When you reflect on what Jesus said, Paul's really just expanding the same ideas and putting them in front of the Colossians for further consideration. In Jesus' famous ethical discourse, the Sermon on the Mount, in the book of Matthew, one of the biographies of Jesus, Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, 'Racha,' is answerable to the court, and anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell. Also, you've heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." I hope you can see that when you compare what Jesus says to what Paul has said in the passage we're looking at, Paul is just bringing up issues Jesus did. And Jesus' point was that sin is fundamentally a heart problem, that before God, none of us have the moral high ground. All of us need to be forgiven. All of us need new hearts. And I think Paul's hinting at the same thing there. Paul is teasing out the point that following Jesus means your heart has a new focus. I don't know if you noticed, but sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires and greed, it shifts from externally observable behaviours to things that are a bit more internal. And then anger, rage, malice, slander, filthy language and lying to each other moves back from the heart to things that are more easily visible, more concrete behaviours. And Paul's also already told his followers, told these followers of Jesus, they are to set their heart on things above. All these things are symptomatic of the heart problem that belonged to your old self before you started following Jesus. The fact that it covers from sex to speech, I think it covers such a broad range and goes back to the heart, I think that suggests that the potential applications really cover every aspect of our lives. But two immediate areas to think about in terms of application, if you're a follower of Jesus, are sex and speech in your life. But again, it's not a moral improvement plan. Notice the start of verse 5, the word therefore. It's a linchpin. The change Paul is commanding for followers of Jesus, it's grounded in the vision of who Jesus is and what he's done and these people's relationship with him. these changes are shaped by the gospel vision. And these changes are necessary if you follow Jesus because, as Paul continues there in verse 9, have a look, you've taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Paul says it's about changing what's appropriate for your role, living out your new identity in Jesus, bearing the image of God. There's a saying from Mark Twain, apparently, clothes maketh the man. And we know what you wear is often associated with what you're doing. And today I'm speaking in the city at lunchtime. It makes sense that I'm wearing a suit. But a few months ago, I had the opportunity to pop down into the Tank Stream there at the north end of Pitt Street, and I dressed reasonably differently. It was a former water source, former sewer, and now stormwater drain. If you're going down into a stormwater drain, you don't wear your suit that you'd wear to the office. You wear your hard hat, your gumboots, the high-vis vest, and the harness. You wear clothing appropriate to the situation you're in. And Paul is saying to these followers of Jesus that, well, they need to change for what's appropriate to their role. Their role is living out their new identity in Jesus, bearing the image of God. And so we turn to the new self and how followers of Jesus are to live and what God's plan for your life looks like in action. Verse 12. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, if anyone has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. In case it hasn't already been underlined enough, this is not a guide on how to become one of God's people. Paul doesn't say, if you are aspiring to become one of God's people, you should do, or if you want God to love you, you must. No, he says, therefore, as God's chosen people. If you are a follower of Jesus, you are one of God's chosen people. If you are a follower of Jesus, you are holy. You are set apart for God's special purpose. That's what holy means. If you are a follower of Jesus, you are dearly loved by God. Not because of things that you've done, but because of what Jesus has done for you when he died on the cross. Because that is who you are, live out that reality. And we aren't going to have time to dig into each of these virtues in depth, though that would be a profitable exercise, I'm sure. But a quick mental exercise, which I think any of us can do, amongst my friends, family, co-workers, I'd like to be known as the blank one. How would you fill that gap? The fit one, the hilarious one, the intelligent one, the pretty one, the trendy one, the fun one? Or what about if I want to live the life I'm made for, I need to be more blank. What would you put there? If I'm honest with myself, when it comes to work, this list that Paul has, they're not words I'm likely to fill those blank spaces with. They're not bad things. I can say that they're good things, but there are plenty of things that seem more urgent to cultivate and develop than being compassionate or kind or humble or gentle or patient or forgiving. They sound good, but I don't think I often think that's the thing I should prioritise cultivating. I wonder if you feel the same. I don't think anyone's going to be against them, but in a dog-eat-dog world, which most of us experience in one way or the other, they're not qualities that are the obvious way to get ahead. They aren't what my heart naturally wants. Paul says I'm to set my heart on things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Just zoom with me into verse 13. That is the one I'll drill into a little bit more. Bearing with each other and forgiving one another if any of you has grievance against someone. Forgiving as the Lord forgave you. Three things to note. First, notice that it's hard. The language of bearing with each other says this is not going to just happen magically. It's going to take effort. In fact, I think all of these things that Paul lists can be costly. It is hard. It takes work. Second, notice the importance of Jesus, again, to what Paul's commanding. It's never by our efforts that we are made right and acceptable before God. We need to be forgiven. The third, just to tease this thought out a little bit more, we can aspire to this list. We might even make progress in these things. But we will fail. We'll fail to do good things that we should do, and we'll fail by doing things we shouldn't. But for followers of Jesus, there's a great hope there. Because even though we might fail, we look to Jesus and remember it's not about us. It's not about what we've done. If it was, we could never do it. Living out the gospel message means change. There are things that will need to be stopped and others that will need to be started. And so it's really all about what the heart wants. Our last point, it ends with Jesus, is just a shorter point. We've seen that it starts with Jesus. We've seen that it's about what the heart wants. And as we've looked at the what you take off and what we put on, and we reach the conclusion of today's passage, we'll see, again, it ends with Jesus. And it's good that it ends with Jesus, because I think I've at least convinced myself I need to be reminded continually of who Jesus is and what he's done. I won't read that last paragraph there, just for time's sake, but notice that it particularly shapes the way followers of Jesus are meant to interact with each other. The message that Paul has been speaking about is something that followers of Jesus are meant to keep speaking to each other. It actually provides quite a strong counterpoint to the way we're not meant to be using words, that we're meant to be putting those off and putting on using words to speak of Jesus. But notice particularly thankfulness. It's there at the end of verse 15, and be thankful. At the end of verse 16, singing to God with gratitude in your hearts. At the end of verse 17, giving thanks to God the Father through him. I don't think Paul's just wagging his finger, giving them an extra thing to do. It's a reminder of just how much followers of Jesus have to be thankful for. Following Jesus and living this way can be hard. There will be challenges. Paul himself is in prison for speaking this message of hope into the world. Yet, there is much to be thankful for. And it's funny, I think giving thanks doesn't just continue to remind followers of Jesus of how much they've been given, but it also helps them remember what they value, about where their heart is, and helps them, again, to fix their eyes on Jesus and set their hearts on things that are above. Because ultimately, it's Jesus who gets us unstuck from our biggest problem of sin. It's Jesus who enables us to live the lives we were made for, lives that bring glory to God. And that's possible wherever you find yourself, whether you are working in a job you love or hate or are unemployed, whether you are single or married, whatever life sphere you are in, Jesus enables us to live lives that bring glory to God in that situation. That's what it means in the Bible to get unstuck and live the lives we were made for. Yeah, so in verse 1 there, so since you have been raised with Christ, so I didn't go into it in a lot of detail today, but it looked back to what we saw last week. Over the last few weeks, we've been unpacking what the message of the gospel is, why it's changed the lives of these followers of Jesus. And the picture that Paul used, he said it has happened, is that by following Jesus, you've become united with him in such a way that your old self, your self that had incurred a debt against God, that you couldn't hope to pay yourself, that debt was paid when Jesus died on the cross. That old self, the self that was going to be punished, was nailed to the cross when Jesus was. And that is how this life is now shaped. Because we're united with Jesus, the old self died with him at the cross, and when God raised him back to life, we have also been raised with Christ. So it's drawing on some of that imagery from last week, and it's providing the impetus for this change. Because you're united with Christ, because the old self is dead, and your new life is with Christ, that's the impetus for the change that we're seeing there. So we tease that out a little bit in the first part, but that goes back to that image that was being used in chapter 2. So from chapter 2, verse 9 to verse 15 that we looked at last week. Yeah, so in chapter 4, verse 8, So chapter 4, verse 10, he says, my fellow prisoner Aristarchus, so it is there. And then he does also say that he's in chains for the sake of the gospel. I was thinking that was verse 8, but I can't quite... Oh, there you go. Chapter 4, verse 3, as he proclaims the mystery of Christ for which I am in chains. It's not a metaphorical. He is actually in prison. Yes, exactly what the... From other parts of the New Testament, there's different types of prison Paul experienced. Sometimes he was, in a dark cell with locked up in chains. Other times it was house arrest. The details of the situation now, is he chained to the wall? Is he chained to a guard but can kind of move about freely in a house? Either way, he's still in prison, and it's because he's been speaking the gospel message.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.